A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants us to dig into the research on healthy conflict resolution in couples and families. Not the just communicate better platitudes, but the actual empirical work. And I think the place to start is this. The single best predictor of divorce isn't how often you fight. It's how you start the fight.
Gottman's harsh startup. His lab could watch the first 3 minutes of a couple's conflict discussion and predict whether they'd still be married 6 years later with over 90% accuracy. That's less time than it takes to brew coffee.
Which is frankly terrifying, but also useful if you know what's happening under the hood. So let's start with what the science actually says about conflict and why most of what we think we know is wrong.
And the first thing to get out of the way is that this isn't about avoiding conflict. Every couple fights. The couples who stay together aren't the ones who never argue. They're the ones who've developed repair mechanisms. The difference is entirely in how the conflict unfolds physiologically and behaviorally, not in whether it happens.
Which is already a useful reframe. Most people walk around thinking, we're fighting too much is the problem. The problem is usually we're fighting badly.
And Gottman's work gives us a remarkably precise picture of what fighting badly looks like at the biological level. He ran what he called the Love Lab, an apartment set up at the University of Washington, where couples would spend a weekend while being monitored. Video cameras, heart rate monitors, skin conductance sensors, cortisol samples. They'd have a 15-minute conflict discussion about a real ongoing disagreement, and the researchers would track everything.
Sounds like a deeply romantic getaway.
Oh, it was science. But the data it produced was extraordinary. Gottman's 1999 meta-analysis. This is across more than 700 couples followed longitudinally, identified specific behavioral patterns that predicted divorce. He called them the four horsemen: criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling.
Of those four, contempt is the big one.
Contempt predicted divorce with 93% accuracy in that analysis. It's not even close. Criticism is attacking your partner's character. You're so lazy. Contempt is worse. Contempt is criticism from a position of superiority. Eye-rolling, mockery, sneering, hostile humor. It communicates disgust. And once contempt enters a relationship, it's not just predicting divorce. It's also predicting how many infectious illnesses the recipient will have in the next 4 years. Gottman found a direct correlation between being on the receiving end of contempt and physical health deterioration.
Wait. So your spouse rolls their eyes at you, and you actually get sick more often.
That's what the data showed. The immune system takes a measurable hit. Contempt isn't just emotionally corrosive, it's physiologically damaging. And here's the mechanism that explains why. Gottman and Levinson, in their 1992 paper, identified something called diffuse physiological arousal, or DPA. When your heart rate crosses about 100 beats per minute, your ability to process language drops by roughly 50%. You literally cannot hear what your partner is saying. The prefrontal cortex, the part of your brain that handles reasoning, impulse control, empathy, goes partially offline. Your body is in fight-or-flight mode.
Just calm down is biologically useless advice.
You can't think your way out of DPA because the part of you that does the thinking is the part that's been hijacked. This is why arguments escalate the way they do. Someone makes a harsh startup. You never take out the trash, and the other person's heart rate spikes within seconds. Now they can only process about half of what's being said. They miss the actual content and respond to the tone. The first person feels unheard, gets more frustrated, escalates further, and you're off.
Walk me through the difference between a harsh startup and a softened one. What's actually happening in the body?
Take the trash example. You never take out the trash. That's a harsh startup. It begins with you, it's a global criticism, and it carries an accusation of character failure. The recipient's amygdala fires immediately. Cortisol starts rising. Heart rate jumps. Within seconds, they're in DPA territory. Now compare, I'm feeling overwhelmed with the housework. Could we figure out a system for the trash? Same underlying complaint. But it starts with, I feel, it's specific rather than global, and it frames the issue as a shared problem to solve rather than an accusation. The recipient's physiology doesn't spike the same way. They can still hear you. They can still access empathy. The entire trajectory of the conversation changes because the first 3 seconds didn't trigger a threat response.
The Sovereign Startup isn't just being polite. It's managing your partner's nervous system.
That's exactly what it is. And this is where most self-help advice falls apart. It treats communication as a cognitive skill. Use I statements, practice active listening, without acknowledging that none of those techniques work if the person you're talking to is in a state of physiological flooding. You can craft the most beautiful I statement in the world, and if your partner's heart rate is 110, they're not going to process it. The intervention has to happen at the level of the nervous system, not just the language.
Which suggests that the first skill in conflict resolution isn't talking. It's recognizing when you're too flooded to talk.
And this is one of Gottman's most practical findings. If you're above 100 beats per minute, you need a break. Not a, I'm storming out, break, but a structured timeout, 20 minutes minimum. That's how long it takes for cortisol to clear from your system. During that 20 minutes, you can't ruminate on the fight. That just keeps the cortisol elevated. You have to actually do something distracting. Read a book. Take a walk. Listen to music. Then come back.
20 minutes of not stewing about the fight. That's harder than it sounds.
But it's the difference between a repair attempt and just pausing the escalation. And repair attempts, Gottman calls them repair attempts, are the other big predictor. Every couple has ruptures. The couples who stay together are the ones who know how to repair. A repair attempt can be anything. A joke, a touch on the arm, saying, I'm getting flooded, can we take a break? Even just a goofy facial expression. The content doesn't matter as much as whether the other person accepts it.
I imagine contempt makes repair attempts nearly impossible to accept.
Because contempt says, I'm above you. If someone who's been rolling their eyes at you suddenly tries a repair attempt, it feels insincere. It feels like another layer of condescension. That's why contempt is the most destructive of the four horsemen. It doesn't just hurt in the moment, it poisons the repair mechanisms that would otherwise save the relationship.
I want to linger on this for a second, because I think there's something subtle here about how contempt and repair interact. If contempt is the poison, is there an antidote? Or once contempt shows up, is the relationship essentially on a timer?
Gottman would say the antidote to contempt is building a culture of appreciation, deliberately, explicitly noticing and naming what you value about your partner, not just thinking it, but saying it. The research on the 5-to-1 ratio we'll get to in a minute, but the mechanism is that appreciation and contempt can't coexist in the same mental space. You can't simultaneously feel genuine gratitude for someone and feel superior to them. So the intervention for contempt isn't to stop being contemptuous, it's to start practicing appreciation. The contempt gets crowded out.
That's a more hopeful framing than I expected. So, contempt isn't necessarily a death sentence if you catch it and actively counter-program against it.
If you catch it early. The problem is that by the time most couples seek help, contempt has been running unchecked for years. The neural pathways are deeply grooved. At that point, appreciation feels forced and artificial to both people. The contemptuous partner doesn't feel it, and the recipient doesn't trust it, so the window matters.
We know what goes wrong, but here's the uncomfortable truth. Even when you do everything right, most conflicts don't actually get solved.
This is the finding that really reframes everything. Gottman found that 69% of relationship conflicts are perpetual. They're not solvable. They're rooted in fundamental differences in personality, values, or life dreams. The couple who argues about how often to visit the in-laws. That's not going to get resolved. One partner wants more family connection, the other wants more autonomy. Those are both legitimate values. They're just incompatible in this specific context.
The goal of conflict resolution for more than 2/3 of conflicts isn't actually resolution.
The goal is dialogue. Gottman distinguishes between what he calls perpetual problems and solvable problems. Solvable problems are situational and specific, figuring out who handles which chores, negotiating a vacation budget. Perpetual problems are the ones that keep coming back, and they're usually about deeper things. The mistake most couples make is treating a perpetual problem like a solvable one. They keep trying to fix it, keep failing, and conclude that the relationship is broken. When actually, the relationship is fine. They're just trying to solve something that isn't meant to be solved.
Like adopting a feral cat.
I'm not sure that's the metaphor I'd reach for, but yes. The reframe is, you're not failing because this keeps coming up. This keeps coming up because it matters. And the task isn't to make it go away, it's to learn to talk about it without destroying each other.
Gottman has a framework for this, right? The dreams within conflict approach?
And this connects to something a clinician named Dan Weil pointed out years ago. He said that choosing a partner is choosing a set of problems. You're not going to find someone who has no conflicts with you. You're going to find someone whose particular set of perpetual problems you can live with. The question isn't, do we have problems? It's, are these problems we can talk about?
Which is a remarkably unromantic way to think about marriage. And also probably the most romantic thing I've ever heard.
It's both. It takes the pressure off. You stop expecting your partner to be conflict-free and start evaluating whether the conflicts you have are navigable. And the dreams within conflict framework is how you navigate the deep ones. The idea is that behind every gridlocked perpetual problem, there's an unexpressed life dream or value. The surface fight is about money, or in-laws, or sex, or housework. But underneath, there's something that matters deeply to each person.
Give me an example. Walk me through what this actually looks like.
Let's take the in-laws fight. Couple has the same argument every holiday season. One partner wants to spend a full week with their parents. The other partner wants 2 days max, then home. They've been having this fight for years. Surface level. It's about scheduling. But if you use the Dreams Within Conflict protocol, you stop debating the schedule and start asking, what's the dream underneath your position? And you listen without trying to fix anything.
What comes out?
The partner who wants the full week. Maybe they grew up in a family where holiday gatherings were the one time everyone actually connected. Their parents are aging. They have this unarticulated dream of their children having the same kind of deep family bonds they remember. The partner who wants 2 days. Maybe they grew up in a chaotic household where holidays were stressful and overstimulating. Their dream is about creating a peaceful, predictable home life that they never had as a kid. Neither of those dreams is wrong. They're both beautiful, actually. But as long as the fight is about how many days, those dreams never get spoken aloud. And because they never get spoken, neither partner feels understood. So they keep fighting about the surface issue, trying to win on logistics, when the real need is to feel that their deeper values are seen and respected.
Once the dreams are on the table, the logistics often become easier.
Not always easier, but different. The conversation shifts from, how do I get what I want, to, how do we honor both of these things that matter to both of us? Maybe the solution is a full week, but with built-in alone time. Maybe it's a shorter visit, but with a special ritual that creates the connection the first partner is craving. The specific solution matters less than the fact that both people feel heard at the dream level. That's what breaks gridlock.
I want to push on this a little, because I can imagine someone listening and thinking, okay, but what if the dreams genuinely can't be honored at the same time? What if one person's dream requires something that makes the other person's dream impossible?
That's the hardest case, and it does happen. But even then, the process changes something. Because what usually makes those situations unbearable isn't the incompatibility itself, it's the feeling that your partner doesn't care about what matters to you. When someone says, I understand that you want to give our kids the kind of holidays you never had, and I want that for you too, even though I also need to protect my own sanity. That's a completely different conversation than you always want to cut the visit short. Even if the practical outcome doesn't change dramatically, the emotional experience of the conflict transforms. You're no longer adversaries. You're two people with competing legitimate needs trying to figure it out together.
The understanding itself is the intervention.
The understanding is the intervention. And that's counterintuitive because we're so trained to think that conflict resolution means finding a solution. But for perpetual problems, resolution isn't the goal. Being understood is the goal.
This doesn't just apply to couples. You mentioned family systems. How does this scale the parent-child or sibling conflicts?
The dynamics get more complicated because of power differentials. With couples, you're theoretically equals. With a parent and a teenager, there's an inherent hierarchy. The parent can't just take a 20-minute break when flooded. They're still responsible for the child's safety. and the teenager can't always articulate their deeper dreams the way an adult partner can, but the same principles apply. The softened startup works with kids. I'm feeling frustrated that the dishes aren't done. Can we figure out a plan? Lands differently than you never do your chores. And the dreams within conflict framework works too. You just have to do more of the excavation yourself, because kids often don't know what's underneath their position.
A teenager slamming their door isn't going to tell you they're dreaming of autonomy and respect.
They're going to show you they're dreaming of autonomy and respect by slamming the door. It's your job as the parent to recognize that the surface fight, about screen time or curfew or homework, is actually about something deeper. And the power imbalance means you have to be more careful. A parent using contempt, mockery, eye-rolling, "you're so dramatic," isn't just damaging the relationship in the moment. They're modeling for the kid that contempt is how you handle disagreement, and kids learn that lesson fast.
There's also the sibling dynamic, which is its own special category of chaos.
Sibling conflict is interesting because it's one of the few relationships where the power differential shifts over time. When they're young, an older sibling has more power. As adults, that usually equalizes. But the patterns set in childhood, who's the responsible one, who's the difficult one, those can persist for decades. And sibling conflicts are almost always perpetual problems. You're not going to resolve the fundamental tension of growing up in the same house with different needs and different experiences. The goal, again, is dialogue. Can you talk about the childhood dynamic without falling back into it?
I've seen this play out in my own family. My sister and I can be having a perfectly adult conversation, and then suddenly we're 12 and 9 again, having the same fight about whose turn it is to sit in the front seat. This speed of the regression is almost comical.
It's instantaneous. And that's because those patterns are stored in the body, not just the mind. Your nervous system remembers the dynamic. When you're with your sibling, the old cues, tone of voice, facial expressions, even the physical space if you're at your parents' house, they trigger the same physiological responses you had as a kid. You can be a 40-year-old with a mortgage and a career, and within 30 seconds you're flooded and acting like a preteen. Recognizing that it's happening is half the battle.
Which brings us to the repair piece. Gottman has a structured protocol for this, right? The aftermath of a fight exercise?
It's a 6-step process. Step 1, each person shares how they felt during the fight, without blaming. I felt defensive when, not, you made me defensive by. Step 2, each person validates the other's experience. Not agreeing with it, but acknowledging that it makes sense given their perspective. I can see why you'd feel that way. Step 3, each person identifies their own triggers, what specifically set them off, and what from their personal history that connects to. Step 4, each takes responsibility for their part in the escalation. Step 5, together you create a plan for how you'll handle this trigger differently next time. Step 6, you discuss what you learned about each other through this process.
That sounds like it takes an hour.
And that's fine. The repair process isn't supposed to be quick. The point is that it's structured. Most couples try to repair by saying, "let's just move on," which means, let's suppress this and hope it doesn't come back. The aftermath protocol forces you to actually process what happened, which is the only way it stops coming back in the same form.
I want to pull on something you mentioned earlier, the magic ratio. 5-1, positive to negative interactions.
This came out of Gottman's 1994 research. He found that stable couples maintain a ratio of roughly 5 positive interactions for every 1 negative interaction during conflict. And this isn't just about being nice. The positive interactions serve as a buffer. When you've built up a reservoir of positivity, affection, humor, genuine interest, appreciation, the negative moments don't hit as hard. Your partner criticizes you, but you have 5 other data points from the same conversation that say, "this person respects me and likes me." So the criticism lands as a specific complaint rather than a global condemnation.
Which loops back to contempt. Contempt isn't just a negative interaction. It's a negative interaction that erases the positive ones.
Because contempt says, "I don't respect you." If you've registered contempt from your partner, all those positive interactions start to feel fake. Were they just being nice to manage me? Do they actually think I'm beneath them? The reservoir drains fast, and once it's empty, every negative interaction lands at full force. That's when relationships tip into what Gottman calls negative sentiment override, a state where even neutral or positive actions are interpreted negatively. Your partner does the dishes and you think, "oh, they want something." That's a very hard state to come back from.
That phrase, negative sentiment override. Feels like it deserves more attention. Because it's not just that you're fighting more, it's that your entire interpretive framework has shifted. You're seeing hostility in neutral actions.
You're discounting positive actions as manipulative. Your partner brings you coffee, and instead of receiving it as an act of care, you wonder what they're about to ask for. It's a profound distortion of perception, and it's self-reinforcing. The more you interpret your partner's actions negatively, the more negatively you behave toward them, which gives them more reason to behave negatively toward you. It's a spiral. Gottman's research suggests that once a couple is in negative sentiment override, the positive to negative ratio has typically fallen below 1:1. They're generating more negative moments than positive ones, and the positive ones that do occur aren't being registered.
Is there a way back from that?
There is, but it's slow. It requires deliberately and artificially increasing the positive interactions. Not waiting until you feel like being positive, but actively creating positive moments even when you don't feel like it. Structured expressions of gratitude. It feels mechanical at first, almost performative. But over time, if both partners commit to it, the reservoir can refill. The interpretive framework can shift back. The key is that both people have to be willing to override their current feelings in service of rebuilding the foundation.
Let's get concrete. Someone listening to this, they recognize the patterns. They want to do something different. What are the actual Monday morning takeaways?
Three things that are immediately usable. First, before any conflict discussion, check your heart rate. If you don't have a monitor, use the Can I Think Clearly test. If you can't, take 20 minutes. Not 5, not 10, 20. That's the minimum cortisol clearance time. And during those 20 minutes, do something distracting, not ruminating.
No rehearsing your rebuttal in your head.
Second, replace you always with I feel and I need. This sounds simple, and it is simple, but it's not easy. The softened startup is a skill you practice, not a personality trait you either have or don't. You'll mess it up. That's fine. The attempt itself, starting with your own experience rather than an accusation, changes the physiological trajectory of the conversation even if you don't nail the wording. For perpetual problems, stop trying to solve them. Instead, ask, what's the dream underneath your position? And then listen, without planning your response, without trying to fix anything. The goal is to understand what this person cares about so deeply that they keep coming back to this fight. That understanding doesn't resolve the conflict, but it transforms it. It stops being a war of positions and starts being a conversation about values.
I'd add a fourth, which is implicit in everything you've said, but worth stating explicitly. Watch for contempt in yourself, not in your partner, in yourself. Are you rolling your eyes? Are you using sarcasm as a weapon? Are you communicating? I'm above this, I'm above you. Because that's the one that does the real damage, and it's often the one we're least aware of in ourselves.
That's well put. And contempt is sneaky. It can feel righteous in the moment. I'm not being mean, I'm just pointing out the obvious. But it's the single most corrosive thing you can bring into a conflict. And the research is unambiguous about where it leads.
All of this research is fascinating, but there's an open question that keeps nagging at me. If 69% of conflicts are unsolvable, what does that mean for how we define a successful relationship?
It means we've been using the wrong metric. A successful relationship isn't one where conflicts get resolved. It's one where conflicts get discussed without destroying the connection. The couples who stay together aren't the ones who figured out the in-law situation. They're the ones who can talk about the in-law situation year after year without contempt, without flooding, without stonewalling. They've accepted that this is their particular set of problems, and they've gotten good at the conversation.
The skill isn't problem solving, it's problem holding.
The skill is being able to hold a disagreement between you without letting it crush the relationship. And that's a very different set of muscles than most people think they need to build.
There's also a future-facing question here. We're starting to see AI relationship coaches, apps that use natural language processing to detect four horsemen patterns in real time, that prompt couples to take breaks when they detect flooding markers. What are the ethical boundaries of algorithmic conflict mediation?
That's a hard question. On one hand, the technology is promising. Most couples don't have a Gottman-trained therapist in their pocket. An app that says, your heart rate is elevated, maybe take 20 minutes, could prevent a lot of damage. On the other hand, conflict is intimate. Having an algorithm analyze your arguments with your spouse. Who owns that data? Who has access to it? What happens if it's subpoenaed in a divorce proceeding?
or what happens when the algorithm is wrong. It misreads tone, flags something as contempt that wasn't, and now you've got a couple doubting their own perception of a conversation because the app said it was toxic.
And there's a deeper issue, which is that the presence of a third-party observer, even an algorithmic one, changes the dynamic. Couples might start performing for the app rather than actually engaging with each other. Or they might offload their emotional awareness onto the technology. I don't need to notice when I'm flooding, the app will tell me. That's not building the skill, it's outsourcing it.
Which is the same tension we see with any augmentation technology. The tool that's supposed to help you build the capacity ends up atrophying it.
This is particularly delicate with relationships, where the capacity in question, emotional attunement, self-awareness, repair, is the whole point. If an app is doing the attunement for you, what's left?
Something to watch. But for now, the core findings are remarkably stable. Gottman's work has been replicated across cultures, across decades. The mechanisms are consistent. And most of what you fight about will never be solved, but it can be understood.
Understanding, it turns out, is enough. Not enough to stop the fights, but enough to survive them.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the interwar period, a team of geologists surveying in Belize's Cayo district advanced the theory that fulgurate glass formed when lightning strikes sand was not a random natural phenomenon, but evidence of ancient electrical engineering by a lost civilization. A hypothesis that survived in academic journals for nearly a decade before being conclusively debunked by a 1927 expedition that found the fulgurate deposits correlated perfectly with the region's documented lightning strike patterns.
So ancient Belizeans were building lightning machines.
Apparently the peer review process in the 1920s was...
This has been My Weird Prompts. We'd love it if you'd leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Go have a fight about the in-laws, but maybe check your heart rate first.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.